We cut 5 hours.
Okay. Insurance. Andrea?
Okay, so today we're going to talk about some of the non-targeted issues that you agreed at the last meeting that you were going to address, and we've brought 4 out of 7 to this meeting. And Connor's going to take us to the first one.
Good afternoon, everybody. Paper 2C discusses whether the board should provide guidance on how to apply the principles in the 2013 ED on how to recognise the contractual service margin in profit or loss. And as Andrew said, it's one of the targeted issues. And in non-targeted. And in paragraph 3 of the paper, we remind the board that the 2013 ED proposed that an entity should recognise the remaining CSM in profit or loss over the coverage period in a systematic way that best reflects the remaining transfer of services that are provided under the contract. The 2013 ED did not say what the services were or describe potential methods for recognising the CSM in profit or loss. Respondents observe that the allocation of patent for the CSM will have a material impact on profit reported by many entities, and in the light of this observation, some are concerned that without further guidance, the subjectivity in determining the pattern of underlying services could create significant diversity in profit recognition. The staff have considered the diversity that the ED would allow or could allow, and in paragraph 44 we provide an example of a non-participating endowment contract for which insurers could reasonably choose, well, opposite patterns of recognition of the CSM. And it's because of the ED could allow this level of diversity that the staff agree with constituents who believe that more guidance is necessary. When developing guidance, we need to identify what the CSM represents and also recognise that because CSMs within the coverage period are not directly observable, any pattern of release that is chosen will, to some extent, be arbitrary. The CSM represents profit that's left over after taking into account expected cash outflows and the risk that the outflows are greater than expected. This equates to the contribution to overheads, not already included in the cash flows, and an element of profit. The contribution to profit arising from the CSM is separate from the compensation for accepting variable cash flows represented by the release or the risk adjustment. Well, it doesn't go on too much longer. The 2013 ED proposed that the CSM is released in a systematic way that reflects the transfer of services, and the defining feature of an insurance contract is that it provides insurance coverage to a policyholder. In other words, it provides the service of standing ready to compensate policyholders if an insured event takes place. The staff believe that the CSM relates to standing ready to provide insurance coverage and that this takes place over time, in line with contributing to overheads and profit. Paragraph 38, the staff summarised their view of the features of releasing the CSM on the basis of time. It's consistent with the service of standing ready. It's relatively easy for preparers to apply. It's easy for users to understand and to predict results. We think it would be relatively easy to audit. It would help increase consistency between the entities and would make profit management more difficult than more complex or subjective methods. Paragraphs 40 to 43 and in Appendix A, the staff note that the pattern of service needs to reflect the expected number of contracts in force. And so finally, in paragraph 48, the staff make their recommendation and ask the following questions. One, does the board agree that it should confirm the proposals in the 2013 ED? I won't read it all now. Two, does the board agree to add guidance out for non-participating insurance contracts? The service represented by the contractual service margin is insurance coverage, which A, is provided on the basis of the passage of time, and B, reflects the expected number of contracts in force. I now turn it over to the board for discussion.
Okay. Stephen?
So I agree with one, but I disagree with two. I agree that we should recognise them on the basis of the pattern of provision of service, but we should deal with the problems that people express by explaining more carefully what we mean by service, rather than them have a rule and say it's the passage of time and reflect the number of contracts in force. I think we need a principle-based standard clearly written principles and sufficient explanations so people can apply those principles in a consistent way. And I think two is just a rule. So for example, paragraph 44, you say 44A, you could assume, et cetera, including deposit components. Well, I think we should provide guidance that you shouldn't include deposit components, for example, in allocating the CSM, because payment repayment of a deposit component is not a provision of a service. So that would be the approach I would take, would be to clarify what we mean by service, for example, saying it doesn't include deposits, rather than provide a rule about how it should be allocated.
So you don't disagree with the outcome of two, but...
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with the outcome of two in some situations, but I'm not sure we should automatically apply that approach in all cases. We should have a principle.
Are there any specific situations in which you're concerned that it doesn't result in the same?
Yeah, it's when the pattern of claims varies over time. Because I think we would get a different answer. If you applied a building block approach to, for example, we have the case of the insurance against storm damage, and storms only happen at a particular time of the year, I think under the premium allocation approach, the principles we have there would give a different answer from the building block approach, and yet we say that the premium allocation approach is a proxy for the building block approach, but you insert this rule for the building block approach and you guarantee almost that you get a different answer.
I don't think we get a different answer necessarily, because with the risk adjustment and the CSM combined, I think you would get a very similar answer.
I don't think that's true.
But there are two things going on there. There's the should we use the pattern of claims, and is the PAA an approximation? And the pattern of claims is a candidate for the way to.
You're ruling it out in two ways.
No, I say it's a candidate for it, but it has its own problems. And when we in 2010 we put that as one of the options, and in fact it sort of became the default in lots of occasions. And the comments that came back were, well, if you look at life insurance, where the likelihood of death is significantly higher at the end, it gives you the terms they used were things like unintuitively back-ended. But let's imagine you've got it sounds a bit dull, but I know that from a mortality table, a 40-year-old non-smoking man, he takes out a 20-year insurance contract that year, his chances of death are quite small. When he's 60, it's 12 and a half times bigger. If we made the pattern of claims, the way to do this, we are assuming that the margin would be 12 and a half times more that year than it would be when he was 40. That's a big assumption to make, and that's what people said in their comments back in on the 2010 ED. So also another feature, or I think issue, with using the pattern of claims, because just imagine we did do that, we get into a situation where you have contracts, you're going to release the CSM according to the pattern of expected claims. Sometime during the coverage period, you change your view on what the pattern of claims is going to be. Therefore, you would adjust the CSM for the present value of that change. You would then change the
Would you?
Well, that's the whole point of adjusting the CSM. If you change your pattern expected claims for the future, that's service.
Future service.
Yes, that's true. Oh dear.
You unlock the CSM.
You may unlock the CSM, would you change the pattern of allocation?
Well, we recognise the remaining margin over the remaining period according to the expected pattern of service. So I think you would, if you thought that the pattern of service is going to change.
And what that heading to is, crikey, it's getting very complicated. And would users be able to, I want to get to a place where people can understand what the profit is. They can go on the back of an envelope and think, well, it should be X, and if the company is reporting Y, I can have a dialogue with them to see why it's different. Whereas if it's just a number they can't understand, that's not an outcome we want, really. So the pattern of claims has its issues, as well, and probably also even over time, but even over time is easier to understand. That's one of the main benefits.
I think pattern of claims is pretty easy to understand.
No, okay. Well, I'm not going. My point there is it would be harder to understand, but I wouldn't ask you to.
Ian,
I hadn't thought of Stephen's idea, so just I was accepting, I think I still do, the general proposition that's made by these questions, that you can give guidance that gives consistency at least, if not always exactly the right answer. The only point I had, and I've discussed it with Connor, is 2B. It seems strange to me that all contracts are equal, so you just take the number.
Yeah, and you're quite right.
And I think there should be some regard to the quantity of them. So a little and big one has more relevance.
You're quite right, Ian. And this paper didn't really go into that. When we do the units of account, we'll deal with it then. The objective would be that, you know, for each contract, you run it off over the expected coverage period. And a contract with a large CSM would run off more CSM than a small one. And if a large contract lapsed unexpectedly, you would release a larger amount of CSM. So the effect of differences in size, we're dealing with through the unit of account side of things. But you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's not. This actually makes it look as if we're treating all contracts the same, and that's not quite right. But we're dealing with the difference in size in our unit of account. Patricia,
I have two questions. And so, how will the proposed pattern of recognition of the CSM affect the pattern of revenue?
Well, it will come through into revenue as part of revenue. My colleague to experts on revenue.
So the revenue consists of expectations of costs and the margin on top of that, both from the exposure from risk and from the CSM. So it's a part of the revenue pattern.
But doing it straight line suggests that the CSM will be recognized straight line. That doesn't necessarily mean that the revenue will be straight line. And so to Steve's point, I can see a situation where the company might want more revenue in the 65th year to cover that additional cost, but still only demand the same margin. So it seems to me that your suggestion is sensible from that standpoint. My other question has to do with a concern about the 2010 ED wording versus what we're proposing now. So in 2010, we said on a straight line basis, but expected claims if different. And the feedback was that neither reflected the exposure from the insurance coverage. The feedback we got was straight line didn't reflect the exposure to the insurance coverage. Now we seem to be saying that we're going to add guidance that the service represented by the contractual surge margin is insurance coverage, and we are stating as a fact that it's provided on the basis passage of time. So it seems to be ignoring the feedback that we got on the 2010 ED, or am I misunderstanding something?
Well, I haven't some people do think it, but there's lots of opinions on what the right pattern is. 2010, a lot of people didn't so much say that time didn't work, it just said it's not the default that you said it was. But there are people who think that the sum of expected claims and movement and risk adjustment is a better way of doing it. And because there isn't, we can't observe them directly, it's you can't really rebut.
So it wasn't really that everybody in the world said straight line didn't represent.
No, not at all.
I think there's a nuance that's missing here, actually, and it's that in 2010 we said that for all insurance contracts participating and non-participating, it was straight line or pattern of claims and benefits. And then we said for investment contracts with DPF, it would be asset management with the build-up of the fair value of the assets under management. And they said there are other services in an insurance contract which we haven't dealt with in this paper, being the asset management services, which were not at all even permitted in the 2010.
Okay.
And since we're not dealing with that now, and we'll come back to think about that, I think that's the nuance.
Okay.
But there are different opinions of what it should be.
But also, the problem was in the respondents' view of the service itself, that for one contract you can argue, depending who you are or what you think about the services are, you can actually come up with different patterns of service. So that's why we thought that allowing more than one pattern of service might not actually lead to consistency. And coming back to Steve's point, we might probably restrict some of them if we say what is not the right one, but probably you still can argue for those contracts of different patterns which were not forbidden.
Gary.
Actually have a lot of sympathy for the claims paid approach methodology, you know, as opposed to the one that's here. However, I think as a group we should recognize that whether it's sort of, I'll call it the straight line method or the staff recommendation or the claims pay method, I think there's valid arguments pro and con for each. I think we could go on forever, you know, and we're never going to get 16 to none on one side or the other here. And so in that case, how would you make a decision? I sort of reluctantly or come around where the staff is, because I like the logic in paragraph 38, which to me is something more of a cost benefit, you know, practicability methodology. But I do think you earn your money by paying claims, because if there was no claims to be paid, your revenues and your premiums would be a whole lot lower than they are. So I think there is never going to be a perfect answer. The question is, can we come up with an answer that can work? I think the logic in paragraph 38 gets you there.
Errol?
I think I've got a lot of sympathy with what Steve said about the perfect option here would be to have a principle-based answer that defined exactly what service was and then released us according to service. I think the concern I've got is that I think we've battled with this issue for a very long time in this project of what exactly that residual service is. And it's worth remembering in the project we define a whole bunch of building blocks, and that each one of those building blocks define what the measurement method is and what the release is. Gary's mentioned claims, but in essence we've covered that already. And I don't think anybody really feels comfortable with an answer that says that if I take a 60-year life policy, I recognize all of the margin right on the very last day when I pay the claim. It feels like there has to be something in between, but the difficulty has been defining that something in between. So if I take the view, if I look at the way that margin breaks down, I've compensated for risk, because my risk margin effectively is how that transfer of risk has been dealt with. I've compensated for the time value of money. That's what my interest is doing in this equation. So I'm left with this little bit at the end, this little bit that we've had difficulty in defining. Now, I think that there may be very limited circumstances where you could actually identify a different recognition pattern with absolute certainty and say, in this circumstance, I would recognize it differently. But the feeling that we've had in talking to most people is that because of the difficulty of getting to this, I get the impression that most people would probably end up with straight line anyway. And all we're doing is helping here, I think, solve the conundrum of what the heck is this and say, well, this is what we think it is, and that's why we think you should go with it on a straight line basis. It does leave one final question of whether we should regard it as an expedient. In other words, try something better first, and if you don't get that right, go for the expedient, or whether we should simply go for, this is the way we want you to apply it. Steve said a rule, and I think it is a rule the way we are suggesting it here. And I think the reason why it probably needs to be a rule is because if we left it as an expedient, we'd leave it as a choice to decide how you wanted to do it. And people could find a way to justify a lot of things. And so I guess at the end of the day, after almost elimination, I'm probably happy with it as a rule.
Mary?
I will bow to Daryl in terms of agreeing that it's a rule or not a rule. But like him, I supported the staff recommendation. And a concern I had, Connor, it might be more about the paper and the tee-up than the recommendation, is it didn't bring out to me a point that Daryl just made in passing, which is that the risk, you know, we made a decision as a board to pull apart the margin into a risk margin and a CSM. And to me, the characterization of claims as potentially an attractive and perhaps valid basis, I would have thought that claims would be a driver for the risk margin, but not the CSM. And since it is the driver for the risk margin, if somebody says, no, the pattern or service I provide for the, you know, as in return for the compensation of the CSM is standing ready, and it's uneven for the, you know, the storm pattern example, I'd say, well, then I think you haven't got the right amount in your risk margin and your release from risk there. So, I mean, okay, novice in the insurance accounting world, but I would have thought that we should be precluding claims basis as the basis for the CSM. And this is the point of making a distinction between what the CSM is and the risk margin is.
Yep. I agree.
so I think, you know, when you very politely say, you know, one could argue, or there's certain attractiveness to using claims basis, that's actually, you know, we're maybe fuzzing the issue if we should be saying, no, claims are released, you know, claims are the actual outcome of the release from risk. You might do better, you might do worse. You don't use it to drive your CSM because that's the part that isn't risk margin.
It's on top of everything else.
Margin.
Yeah, I also think we should not give this rule based over time, because I think the principle is clear. It's the systematic way in which the insurance coverage is provided. And there are cases where insurance coverage is not provided straight line over time. I said in the small group meeting, my skis are insured, and if I have a 3-year contract, and clearly my insurance coverage is really only for the months which I am to skiing, which is maybe November to March and not really in August and July. And I would expect really then, if the principle is the providing of services, I would not see, okay, that they provide me services with insurance coverage in August and July. And therefore, I think it should be more principle-based, and we should not give this rule.
But why isn't that the risk margin? Because the company is released from risk in an uneven pattern when you think about when it's likely to suffer.
No, the risk I would accept, but also insurance coverage for me is something different, because if there is not something which is insured, which is not any substance, because there is not any risk, what is insurance coverage without risk? I think it's nothing. If you don't have the risk in this month, what is insurance coverage?
So you need to say you don't go skiing in Argentina during the summer?
No, I have excluded that.
You want to go to Chile.
But seriously, would that mean that we would require them to take the profit in 3 months during the year?
I think give the principle and say, okay, that principle is what we have this explained here in question one, which is how the pattern of services. And then I think people can explain if it is over time, how they have used it, or based on other things, and that is sufficient. Why should we give for all circumstances one rule? I don't think that will help improve financial statements and information.
But then what's the difference between the CSM and the risk margin?
That is a good question, but...
I think that's the answer.
So in IAS 16, we say depreciate according to the consumption of the asset. We don't say straight line. In the new IFRS 15, we recognize profit on a long-term contract on the basis of the delivery of service. We don't say allocate it straight line. Why is this special? Now, you give the example of the endowment contract. I think that should be front-loaded, the profit in that, because actually you're not really providing any insurance coverage late on, because the deposit will likely get to a point where you get more back from the deposit than you would from the insurance coverage. There isn't really any insurance. It's all front-loaded, the insurance. I think in term life, it should be back-loaded, because I think that's when you're really providing the service.
And the risk adjustment will reflect.
But not really, because some of these contracts are very profitable, and the risk adjustment is only a portion of that profit.
Yeah. Contributions to overheads and profit.
But
I support the staff recommendation, but I'm empathetic to the point that Stephen is making. When I first read the first question, I saw a systematic way. That makes sense to me, but then the second sentence begs that question. It goes right to a specific kind of rule. I actually like the outcome here. I don't like the way it was set up, per se. But the one thing I would just say is that we are contradicting ourselves a little bit in that discussion we had last month when we talked about how revenue should be recognized. We've been talking for years now that it's based on the pattern of service that's being provided, and we said the principal service being provided in an insurance contract is coverage, insurance coverage, and the way expected claims are to be incurred.
But the staff just confirmed that revenue won't be straight.
I don't disagree with you, Pat. So what I'm saying is there's an inherent disagreement here in the way we define service for revenue recognition and service for release of the CSM. It's different.
I agree it's different. I think what we're saying is that service for revenue is the service for all the components. So it's the risk-bearing service as well as the coverage service. We're here now talking only about the component which is pure insurance coverage. So there are multiple components which go into revenue, but we're talking about only
argument.
One of them.
I think would CSM is an amalgamation of many things that you can't put your finger on.
But then if it's a residual, how can you say that one pattern is
and
better?
And Pat, I think that's perhaps the difference. I think we are agreeing with revenue here, because what we're defining in some ways is we're defining the service to which CSM relates as a standby service, because we've taken account of everything else, so all that's left is standby. Then we're saying standby is something that happens over time. So the way that you would then measure standby under revenue or anything else, once you've taken account of everything else.
I don't think you can make that assertion, though, Darrell, that's the only thing that's left.
Okay, Sue,
anyway.
And then let's vote.
In response to Steve's comment about why doesn't a principal work here in the same way it does, for example, in IAS 16, I think it's because people are battling more of trying to understand what it is we're trying to capture. So I think whereas people have a better idea of what the useful life concept is, and the feedback that we've got, it's clear that people have got different ideas of what we mean about the service of insurance. So I think the first thing we're trying to do is help with that. And to the point that Mary's made and that Darrell just made, I thought the key thing that we were trying to capture here was really this sort of standby notion and approach two, which I think is gives us the clarity and makes it a bit easier potentially for people, and clear captures that concept, which is why I could accept it.
Okay. Question one, I suppose that the board can agree with, that's the principle. Can we see
16 and 30?
Question two, where we translate the principle into a rule.
Three against.
13
over. All right.
Thank you. So now I will present agenda paper 2D. That discusses three other non-targeted issues that the ISP decided in April 2014 to consider further. I'm going to discuss these three issues one by one, and I will ask the board to discuss them and take the decision before moving to the next issue. So let's start with the first issue that's on pages 2 to 5 of the agenda paper, and that's fixed fee service contracts. We received some comments that scoping out fixed fee service contract from the standard of insurance contract would result in additional costs to some companies, because they currently bundle fixed fee service contract, fixed fee service together with insurance contract and account for them together. To address this issue, we recommend on page 5 to permit but not require to account for fixed fee service contract in accordance with revenue recognition standard. Does the ISP agree with this recommendation?
Yes.
Is there a comment? Sorry. Yes.
Well, I don't agree with it, because I can't see that an option improves IFRS in any way. And if we're doing it because people are concerned that they're going to have to change, it seems to me that they're going to have to change, somebody's going to have to change when they apply IFRS 15 anyway. So I'm not sure what we're getting by allowing an option. So it seems to me that there shouldn't be an option.
Well, by the option, we want to allow entities to keep the standards that they apply at the moment, because right now some companies apply for fixed fee service contract the insurance accounting standard, and some of them apply revenue recognition standard. And the option would allow both of them to keep the current standard, so they would not have to pay additional cost of changing the standard and changing the accounting method that they have at the moment. Yeah, and we believe that comparability will not be impaired by this option, because for this type of contract that should be quite simple, actually there will be not much difference in practice between revenue recognition standard and insurance accounting standard principles.
It is not certain that they will have to change in applying IFRS 15. They may have a current accounting method which is perfectly consistent with what IFRS 15 will require.
Well, I think for those that combine insurance with a fixed fee service contract, I think if they applied 15, they would have to separate those, because there probably are standalone selling prices for those two things, and they're not intricately, I can't remember the language that we used in 15. It's late in the day.
Beryl?
I support the staff view on this one, and I think it's because the fixed fee contract provision in the standard at the moment is an exception. So we define everything that's insurance standards, and then we make an exception for some things. What this effectively does is it limits where that exception is going to be used. So the exception will be used less frequently than what it might otherwise be used for things that are at the first point defined as insurance and then accepted from the insurance definition. So I'm comfortable, because I think the implication of it is on the right side. Insurers will be able to use consistent accounting across the board for things that we would otherwise have called insurance.
Well, if we required them to use insurance accounting for things that we would otherwise call insurance, I wouldn't have a problem. But what we're doing is permitting them a choice of either doing that or applying 15. And that's what troubles me.
I think Pat, the background to that is simply that we don't want to define who an insurer is. Yes. And so in the circumstance here,
if you're providing addition, where this becomes a problem is for those that add additional insurance. Am I understanding this right? That where this is a problem is those that add additional insurance to a fixed fee service contract?
Or add a fixed fee service contract to insurance, I think is more. I think it's a philosophical question about which standard they see themselves in, and we've made other exceptions and other options in this standard to accommodate
that situation.
So we're
doing management's view.
It's in some ways it is, particularly because we think that the accounting is not actually going to be very different.
It just seems to me that if we could make the cut, those that either add fixed fee service to insurance or add insurance to fixed fee,
yep,
have to apply the insurance standard, and everybody else applies 15. To me, that's not an option, and that's a sensible division, and I would be happy with that. That's
to be honest, Pat, I have a lot of sympathy with your view, and if we were at an ED stage and that was what we're proposing, then I would be more than happy to take that view. I'm a little bit nervous because of who we'd be affecting, and I think that's part of the driver why I'm comfortable with it being an option as well.
Mary?
Pat, on your concern, going back to Daryl's point, if these things meet the definition of an insurance contract, And previously we said, okay, we think it's going to be too hard. As a practical expedient, let's carve them out. I think what we're saying is these are insurance contracts. Let's make the practical expedient elective rather than mandatory.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, I think your question is whether we give specifications for use of an elective practical expedient beyond saying they are insurance, but we aren't going to require you to, as a practical expedient, you may elect to account for them as revenue. If so, disclose that you do. Does thinking about it that way make it any easier?
I'm seeing ghosts under the bed where they aren't there, but it seems to me we're making it an option.
Yeah. I mean, mine would be option two, but it would say you've got to basically say that you're claiming it as a practical expedient rather than saying, hey, make a choice, here's an accounting policy election.
Stay in insurance.
They are insurance.
Yeah, just to kind of maybe alleviate some of Patricia's concerns, I think what you need to add to the question is that this election should be, in my opinion, at an entity level, so that you can't do one contract this way, another contract that way. So it's an entity level election. So if I'm AAA or the auto club, I'm not going to do, you know, partial insurance contract accounting, partial rev rec accounting. I'm going to do one or the other.
Right.
That should help comparability within the periods and across entities. And it's an election at the time you adopt the standard, and that's it.
Yep.
That would be better.
Yes.
I don't know whether the staff agrees with me or not.
I think we'd need to think about it first and how we'd word that.
Okay.
I think we always had comfort that in ISA, again, the accounting policy choice, that similar transactions be treated similarly. And that would give enough discipline here that we saw it in this case, that you wouldn't have this kind of cherry picking idea.
I'm not sure. I don't think they'd necessarily see.
Well, you could say, I mean, in revenue,
types
I think
of insurance is.
We said something in revenue to sort of say that, you know, if you adopt practical expedience, you have to treat, you know, you have to treat everything consistently.
Yep.
So similar contracts, you can't do some practical expedience on and not on others. So you've got to be consistent. And I think that's what you're thinking here, isn't it?
Yes.
That would be an accounting policy choice, would it?
Exactly.
Consistently,
but it's not quite the same as specifying that at the entity level that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just no, my you're right. I'm proposing a different recommendation, which I prefer over the one that Joe described.
So should we vote the staff recommendation?
Yeah, and shall we see who can support the staff recommendation?
Let's move to the second issue then. It's described on pages 5 to 7 of the agenda paper, and it relates to significant insurance risk guidance. We received some comments that the additional guidance that was added in 2010 to the exposure draft would result in some specific contract not meeting the definition of insurance contract. The guidance stated that there must be a possibility that the cash outflows from the entity will be higher than the premium on a present value basis. To address this unintended consequence, we recommend on page 7 of the agenda paper to modify the wording of this guidance to make it clear that there must be a possibility of a loss on a present value basis. Does the ISB agree?
Comment. Any disagreement? No disagreement.
Okay. Thank you. That brings us to the last issue in this paper. That's pages 8 to 10, portfolio transfers and business combinations. And we received some comments that the wording in the exposure draft is not clear regarding the contracts acquired through portfolio transfer or business combinations, which are in the settlement period. To address this issue, we recommend on page 10 to modify the wording of the exposure draft to clarify that the ISB's intention was that the contracts that are acquired through portfolio transfer or business combination should be accounted for as a new contract. Are there any comments?
No.
it's not really a new contract because the same contract exists. You've merely transferred it to somebody else. If it is a new contract, well, how do you allocate the CSM? Because the coverage period has expired. There is no coverage period because there is no new contract. So over what period do we do this straight line allocation?
Well, it is. If you're treating it as if it were a new contract, then you're treating it as if it had a new CSM, and you're treating it as if the insured event is not the original insured event, but it's an insured event about the ultimate discovery of the losses being bigger than what you had expected when you entered into the business combination or the portfolio transfer. So you would make an estimate of when you thought that those claims were going to come in, and you would allocate the CSM over that period.
On a straight line basis?
On a straight line basis. As per the board's recent decision.
And you'll explain that in the standard?
I can explain. Well, we already have paragraphs that virtually explain this idea about contracts and settlement when you've got the insured event that's happened and it's just the discovery of the losses. We've already got those paragraphs, so we can lean on those.
Okay, Stephen is happy now.
I didn't say that.
Can we agree with the staff recommendation?
So two against.
14.
Yep. 14.
So that concludes our board meeting.
Forgot B, haven't we got this?
What?
Okay, well in that case I haven't finished. Because business combinations.
Oh, I thought she was talking about the whole lot.
You done both, had you? I didn't realise.
Would you like
can
to?
Can I?
Yeah, it's a joint recommendation.
Was it?
Yeah.
Can I talk about business combinations?
Of course.
Are we overriding fair value in business combinations?
It was always a question of what you were going to do, whether you were consistent with both business combinations and whether you were consistent with the insurance standard. So what we have said is we are consistent with business combinations as long as it kind of makes sense in terms of the model itself. So for example, we use fair value when your fair value is in excess or higher than the fulfillment catch result, because then effectively you're paying for something else. So this new service idea or a new valuation of that service idea, and therefore it would be fair value. So you would be consistent with business combination. What happens then is, what if the fair value is lower than your fulfillment cash flows and you paid too little or whatever? You either go with fair value, which would be lower than the fulfillment cash flow, so you would have a liability that's lower than your fulfillment cash flow, or you have your fulfillment cash flows itself. In that instance, the board previously decided it's more consistent to go with the fulfillment cash flows rather than fair value.
I think this gives a structuring opportunity, because the fulfillment cash flows includes a risk margin, and the risk margin, the risk adjustment, is entity specific. You can effectively choose what that is. You make that high so that it's bigger than the fair value. It gives you lower goodwill, gives you a higher liability, and gives you higher post-acquisition profit.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should limit the amount of the liability to the fair value. You shouldn't go above the fair value because of that structuring opportunity.
And Steve, that's broader than just this question, though.
Yeah.
It's not just for these circumstances. You're talking about all business transfers,
yes.
Or all business combinations.
Yes.
Yes.
He's talking.
No, but we'll.
That's a decision we made before.
I think we should move away from the principle of fair value in business combinations very cautiously. We should be prudent. And we shouldn't overstate
that's
income.
How the standard setter applies prudence.
Yeah, I see your point, Steve.
I think in terms of what we got that we were dealing with, and remember this is a non-targeted issue, this was, we were clarifying what we had proposed in the 2013 exposure, well, 2010 and 2013 exposure drafts. And they were requesting the comment letters for clarification. There wasn't a great call for a change in what we were proposing.
Mary?
Dangerously asking a question to which I don't know the answer yet at the table, which is...
Do you normally then know the answers to all the
questions? No. About insurance. But right now under IFRS 3, just looking quickly through the main body of the text, I haven't gone to the Appendix B, there doesn't seem to be an exception for insurance contract liabilities in terms of the initial recognition and measurement, but I will bet you that insurance contracts that are acquired in a business combination, are they booked at fair value, or are they measured in accordance with IFRS 4,
I thought there was an exception for current IFRS 4. I would need to find it for you. I know that going forward, we definitely made it very clear with a consequential amendment to the relevant paragraph. Do you have the ED?
Yes, it's on paragraph B63B, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at the main body, but I haven't looked at it.
So you really have an exception.
So we have already confirmed that we intend to have an exception that the requirements of the insurance standard override the requirements of the business combination standard. So, Steve, to your point, this isn't new just for the subset of coverage period completed contracts.
It is wider.
Do we want to revote?
Yes,
on the
business
combination.
So it's a staff recommendation in its entirety.
Fifteen in favour.
Yes, okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.